William Snell.
Thank you. Good morning. How's my sound? You all can hear me okay? Okay, good. Well, we've been having a technological adventure up here. Mostly people, not me, because I'm technologically illiterate. But it looks like the adventure is just about over, and we're just gonna, as I was saying, paint pictures with words instead. I'll try to describe what you would be seeing and what you would have seen, but we should be just fine without that. So thanks, Thais. I'm so glad to be here. Evangelicalism and Homosexuality, Revisiting the History, is the title that you would see up here right now. And just a couple of questions to get a sense of the kinds of words and kinds of images that come to your mind when you hear that title, or just that term, evangelicalism, for starters. You can hazard a definition if you feel brave, or just any words, phrases, or images that come to your mind when you hear that word.
Conflict.
What a great word.
Conservative.
Hypocrisy. Okay.
Something that we should all be.
I'd love to hear more about that and more about conflict, too, if you can elaborate. Because I like where you're going. There's nothing wrong with what you said, but why should we all be it? Oh, it's a real question.
Well, the term is a biblical term, that we have the good news to proclaim, and as Christians, we should be evangelical. It's how others may have taken the term and, to my mind, abused it, but I don't think the term itself, in its origins, is something that we should shy away from.
Thank you. And then conflict, yeah. Do you mind elaborating?
Sure, I think my perception is people, it may be a distorted form of evangelicalism. I've just been, kind of summarizing this briefly before, growing up with internal conflict about what they're being taught and what they're being driven to interpret from Scripture.
Thank you. Other words, phrases, things that come to mind?
The family I grew up in.
The family grew up in. Me too. Yeah.
The book, A Time to Embrace. You know the book?
Is this by...
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. These are all great words. They all testify to what I think is just the obvious reality. If this term comes up in conversation today, conflict is a great word, just multiplicity. There are all sorts of connotations of all sorts of stripes. You've got the political that I hear, social political maybe coming in, but also the theological and the devotional. It's about faith, but it's also about society, and it's about an individual's heart and their own life with God, but it's also about this larger demographic, this larger movement in the world and the nation. So how about with homosexuality, evangelicalism and homosexuality together? Same kind of variety, same kind of conflict, or is there... what words or what images come to your mind when you see those two together? Think of the relationship of one to the other.
Judgment.
Intolerance.
Non-sequitur. Any others?
Opportunity.
Okay. At least for me, and I gather for you all too, the variety that I heard in answering that first question doesn't come through quite as much in the second. So there is more variety if I'm thinking about evangelicalism in the world today. All sorts of things that one can mean by that. But if I'm talking about what evangelicals think or believe about homosexuality or the relationship of these two, the meanings, the words and phrases start to kind of narrow into the same kind of thing, right? Judgment is a word that comes to my mind, to a lot of people's minds. I remember my senior year in high school, there was a book that came out called Unchristian that everyone in my evangelical youth group was talking about a lot. And one of the messages of this book was that if you ask your average American, based on this sample set, right, if you ask people what do they think of when they think of Christianity, the word that will come up the most, and I think it was something like 90% of folks will name pretty much right off the bat, anti-homosexual. Now, this book was published by an evangelical publishing house, and the kinds of Christians that were in their sample set were these kinds of, from these evangelical communities. And what I remember hearing as a high schooler, as we read this book, as we talked about this book, was that, well, this is a problem that 90, 91% of unchurched people think of this right away. And so the solution to this problem is that we Christians, we evangelical Christians, need to figure out how to be more loving in holding our what we all understand to be the position that we must hold because we're evangelicals. And I was totally into that. Yes, we need to figure out how to be more loving. And then it didn't occur to me until years later, huh? We were all just taking as self-evident that the position that we all knew evangelicals held about homosexuality, that of course 90% of folks would automatically think of that position, this position that's about 5% of the population, this position that wasn't really a thing in public discourse more than 100 years ago, that this is central to the Christian faith, as all these people understand it. And that's weird. And it didn't strike me as weird. It didn't strike me as anything to question until years after this conversation in my youth group as a senior in high school. So a big part of my research, a big part of the questions that drive me as a student of religion and of history and of evangelicalism and of sexuality is how did we get here? How did we get to the point, and how did I get to the point where it was just self-evident? Well, that of course, what evangelicals, however defined, think about this 5% of the population, that that's going to be a defining feature of this movement, of this faith. And as I continued to ask that question and search for answers to that question and dig into the history, one of the things that I discovered and one of the things that's a central goal of my research is to show that the history of these two things together, the history of evangelicalism and homosexuality, has more variety, has been more variable over the years than many of us have come to assume. That history has not been static. It has, in fact, changed over time. That history hasn't been monolithic. There have, in fact, been differing perspectives within evangelical circles, different perspectives competing with each other about how evangelicals should treat homosexuals, respond to gay people. Some of those perspectives that were competing in those circles were, in fact, what folks today would call affirming perspectives. This history of evangelicalism and homosexuality ultimately wasn't inevitable. Meaning that I've looked at the history and I've seen that there were particular moments in time along the way where it looked like just maybe things could have gone a different direction than they did. And they didn't. They went this other direction, right? So the point of my research is not to say, no, actually, I know you all think evangelicals are super homophobic, but they're not. That's not the point. But the point is to recognize just this plurality, this multiplicity, this variety in the history that has not just gone unnoticed, but I'd say been covered up. So what you would see here, what I'm going to try to talk us through, since you aren't going to be able to visualize it, is just a few major shifts that I've seen in my own research from the 50s to the 80s in evangelical discourse on homosexuality. Yeah. Such a good question.
In Allentown, there was Evangelical Lutheran Church of America all around. I don't think of those people as what you're describing. And I'm wondering, you know, and all of us Christians, as Herrick has said, was we should be all evangelicals, right? So what is it that we're defining here? Because I think if you look in the media, you're going to find out that all Christians are homophobic.
Right.
Because in the narrative that you see in the media. Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Your name?
Keith.
Keith, thank you for this question. I went back and forth for a while about should I start by going down that rabbit hole, or should I maybe come back to that rabbit hole during the question and answer? And it's time to go down the rabbit hole, okay? But I'm going to see if I can spend, let me check. I'm going to see, no, we're going to try to do this rabbit hole in 2 minutes. That's my goal, okay? Here's what I mean, and I'm so right, you ask 100 different people, they're going to say 100 different things. Here's what I mean when I use that term as a scholar, as a historian of evangelicalism. So this term came into popular use during the Reformation. It came into popular use in German, evangelisch or whatever, and it was a term that reformers like Luther and others used to describe their faith, their church. And so what they meant was basically, we're not Catholic, right? Our faith is an evangelical faith. We are an evangelical church. And we're not a Catholic church. And there were all sorts of connotations, right, what Luther meant when he was describing his faith, his church, those sorts of connotations about the Bible, about liturgy, etc. And that's the sort of thing, the sorts of connotations that that term had for centuries. Until the late 19th, early 20th century, we start to see the term shift. And the way it shifts is that it begins to be used for the first time not just as an adjective, and again, pretty consistently for those centuries, as an anti-Catholic adjective, to say, well, my church is an evangelical church, is to say, well, we're not Catholic. And over the 19th century, it also means it's, you know, well, the Mormons are unevangelical, the Unitarians are unevangelical, but we have an evangelical church, by which they mean we are true to the euangelion, to the gospel, variously defined, right? People mean different things when they say that. But what they're saying is that we are true to the gospel, truer to the gospel than those folks, whoever they are. They're almost always Catholics, but there are others too. So by the time you get to the late 19th, early 20th century, this starts to shift. It ceases to be just an adjective and becomes a noun. You start to see certain communities, certain institutions, certain schools, certain businesses say, I am an evangelical. We are evangelical. This is our religious identity. And we see this, for me as a historian, I'm going to go back to the concrete institutions rather than try to talk about denominations in a broad swath sort of way, or to try to talk about individuals, right? There are particular schools, publishing houses. One of the periodicals that we're about to look at, Christianity Today, is a key institution in this regard. Folks who said, we are evangelical, and we sell evangelical books, and you should buy them, because you too are an evangelical. Now the meaning there, okay, I'm at my 2 minutes for sure. What the term means is, of course, contested and has been all the way through. That's part of the point. When I say evangelical, I mean, okay, over the course of the 20th century, certain communities, certain institutions got a hold of this term, made it into their primary religious identity, over and against other Christians who they said are not true to the gospel. And I'm interested not so much in saying, well, what is the once for all, across time, across place, this is what a true evangelical is. That's a theological question. That's not what I do as a historian. I say, let's look at these people who laid claim to this term and in the media and otherwise successfully laid claim to it. What is the narrative that they have crafted about who is and who is not an evangelical, who is not a Christian, and what Christians, what evangelicals believe about homosexuality? That's the narrative that I'm interested in and that I think the history revisited interrogates. Does that make sense?
Okay. Is Joel Osteen an evangelical preacher?
You'd have to ask him or ask all manner of events. Yeah, I'd say that the Pentecostalism, the prosperity gospel stream that he swims in and helped to make is one of the streams in the evangelical flow. But again, the fact that a lot of evangelicals, very prominent evangelicals, critique him and even want to exteriorize him from their understanding of evangelicalism is all part of the point, right? This is a messy, contested, perennially contested thing, in part because it's a way to identify as an evangelical, is a way to say, we're the true Christians, they're not. We have the gospel, the Euangelion, they don't. Yeah. Like I said, I decided, ultimately, well, we'll see if that comes up in the Q&A, but it's good to have this happen. Now, to get a bit of that out on the table. So, the history that I'm going to mention, that I'm going to try to walk us through with my words, is one that I've seen in this periodical called Christianity Today that was known in the 50s when it was founded through the 20th century, known by many as the leading evangelical periodical in the U.S. They helped make this evangelical brand as it exists now. And so what I'd have up here for you is a table where we're going to look at how evangelicals in Christianity Today talk about homosexuality and the Bible in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s all the way through. So you're just going to have to listen to me describe this table, or we'll talk about those different decades along the way, and hopefully you'll get an image, again, of the kinds of shifts that have happened over time. Get a sense of the ways in which, despite evangelical rhetoric today, things have changed. And then along the way, as I'm talking about these shifts, I'm also going to try to introduce a few of the subjects of my research, a few of the subjects of my dissertation, folks that I'm calling evangelical gay activists, by which I mean, so it's a good thing that we talked about this beforehand, by which I mean these are folks who came from those institutions. These are folks who wrote for Christianity Today and who worked for InterVarsity and other organizations, other institutions that said, we are evangelical. By which I mean also folks who learned to, as they were working in these institutions, use their discourses, speak their language, so to speak. And lastly, by which I mean I'm going to talk about some of these evangelical gay activists, I mean that other folks in the media, in the secular media, in the religious media alike, called them evangelical, or at least said they looked pretty evangelical. And so we're going to talk a bit about those folks in a bit. But we're going to start with the 50s. So Christianity Today is founded in 1956. For the first 4 years of this periodical, this evangelical periodical writing, there are zero articles focused on homosexuality, about homosexuality, in these first 4 years until 1960. And in between 56 and 66, for this periodical's first decade, a handful of articles in total in 10 years that are about homosexuality. When I discovered this, this shocked me as someone who knows this periodical and other evangelical discourse more recently pretty well. I assumed that it would come up all the time, or at least multiple times a year, multiple times all around, but it doesn't. For the first 10 years, it really doesn't. It's pretty rarely, pretty infrequently discussed. And so what I'd love to ask you is why? What do you think? And there's no stupid guess, it'd just be fun, I think, to get a sense for us to kind of brainstorm together why in the 50s, in the 60s, might Christianity Today not have been talking about homosexuality as often as they do now, or as often as other evangelicals do now. Yeah.
I have to guess that there was still a lot of in the closet homosexuality. It wasn't out in the public as much. It wasn't a movement. And so why would they waste pages on that? This wasn't a part of what they felt they needed to go after in society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good guess. Yeah, other thoughts? Yeah.
Following up on what Keith said, so it wasn't very evident in the general But that all changed in the 70s with the anti-war movements and Haight-Ashbury, and that's where homosexuality became more visible in the media.
Yeah, thank you. That's also a good guess, yeah.
Money.
Money, say more.
More people will buy your magazine if you talk about something sensational.
Okay. So the sensation wasn't there in the wider culture in the 50s and 60s like it was in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Is that what I'm hearing? Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Holly?
Were there many articles about sexuality at all?
Great question. Great question. There are a lot of articles about smut. And we think of these, by the way, this is like we've got our image of the 50s and then our image of the 60s. The fact is, people in the 50s were still talking about the problem of sex obsession, the problem of smut, deviancy, sex obsession, sex perversion. I'll say more about that in a minute. But yeah, they're talking a lot about sex. They're worried a lot about sex. And homosexuality, in that word, or in a word like inversion, or in a word like deviancy, will come up in some of these articles in passing. Our country has these problems with pornography and with divorce and with adultery and with homosexuality and with this and da-da-da-da-da. So there are a handful of articles in which it comes up there, just in passing. But I heard one of the things I heard in your question and a few of these guesses that are all good guesses. It wasn't as... folks didn't feel as free to talk about it. It was a bit more taboo still. And that's starting to change in this time, right? Alfred Kinsey in 1948, bestseller, Sexual Behavior of the Human Male. That opens up public discourse unlike anything else before it. So do the Army-McCarthy hearings. So does what's called the Lavender Scare. The first time the word homosexual is ever spoken on TV, public TV, millions and millions of folks are hearing it, and they're hearing it during the Army-McCarthy hearings in 54. So folks' ideas of what a homosexual is as it's entering public discourse in a really prominent way for the first time, right? Those ideas are being formed in part through this communist lens. There's more to say about that, but we're not going to get down that rabbit hole. Last thing I'll say about this 50s, 60s period, it's infrequent, it's because things are discussed more frequently in general, it's also because homosexuality is understood as one of any number of problems related to sexuality in mid-century America. It is like adultery, it is like pornography, it is like sexual assault, in that it is a moral failing, a moral sickness that we as a society need to tackle together through the same sorts of things. Again, there's a big anti-communist vein here. One of the things that I want to be sure to cover before moving on, and I'm realizing I'm going to have to move more quickly because 10:20 is my time, yeah? Does that sound right? Yeah. But before then, because we want more time for Q&A. The one thing I want to be sure to mention about the 50s and 60s before we move on to the 70s and 80s, and I'm going to come back to the time frame that you gave us about the 70s being this time when folks are coming out and there needs to be more to address. Anyone know when the word homosexual first appears in an English Bible? In a Bible. It hasn't always been there. The word homosexual in an English Bible. It's in 1946, and this matters for the conversation because it's not only the case that in the 50s and 60s, homosexuality is discussed relatively infrequently. It's also the case that homosexuality and the Bible are discussed infrequently. So when homosexuality does come up, they aren't citing Bible verses. In this first decade, at least, they aren't coming up. And one of the reasons for that is because it's not until 1946 when the New Testament of the Revised Standard Version is published, that the word homosexual is in an English Bible. The King James Version is what is used most widely for centuries. And even after 1946, part of the reason why it's not coming up super frequently, I think, why Bible verses aren't being cited quite as frequently in Christianity today, is because evangelicals don't like the RSV at first, or at least a lot of them don't like the RSV. It's a liberal project. It's a liberal mainline Protestant project. That's not their thing. They're scared of it.
I was told it was a communist project.
Just very much going back to this. So it's not until 1946 that anyone can open their English Bible and say, well, what does the Bible say about homosexuals? Well, it's right here. It's right here in my Bible. Things start to change in the mid-late 60s. Say it once more.
Where in the New Testament in 1946 is it mentioned?
1 Corinthians 6 / 1 Timothy 1. What was in the King James Version, abusers of themselves with mankind, which you can tell me what that means if you have an idea. A lot of folks thought it meant masturbation. But that becomes, so the Greek words are malakoi and arsenokoite in 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Timothy 1. One of them becomes sexual perverts, I believe. One of them becomes homosexuals. And the initial version of the RSV, now that's going to get revised, of course, later on. But it comes up in one of these two Pauline letters. And there's so much more we were going to talk about, but I've got to keep moving more quickly. So scripture does start coming up. I mentioned that first decade, things look this weird kind of way. In the late 60s, mid and late 60s, scripture starts to come up more and more. And it's not coming up because of the gay rights movement. Because that, as you said, right, we start to see, at least in the general narrative, right, well, we've got Stonewall in 1969, and then the Gay Liberation Front is founded shortly after that, and all of a sudden we've got a gay rights movement, and that's what all the evangelicals care about. They're freaked out about all the gays running around in society, and that's when they start talking about homosexuality, and that's not true. They start talking about homosexuality more frequently, and they start talking about homosexuality and the Bible substantively for the first time in the mid and late 60s, and it's not because of a secular gay rights movement, it's because of Christians. It's because of Christian ministers, Christian theologians, in different denominations, some of which evangelicals aren't usually associated with, like Episcopalians, but some of which they are, like Methodists. And it's because Christians are starting to say, well, you know what, maybe we need to reevaluate this stance on homosexuals. Maybe what McCarthy is saying, what all these folks are saying, maybe we need to proceed a bit differently. And usually this looks political in that it just looks like advocating decriminalization. So
where did that, where in the wider Christian church did that start?
The reconsideration? Yeah, we start seeing a small fledgling movement of ministers on the West Coast, San Francisco, LA area in 1964. They form what's called the Council on Religion and the Homosexual. And this includes Episcopalian, Methodist, maybe one or two Presbyterian ministers, but Episcopalian and Methodist ministers primarily. And what they're saying initially isn't, they're not talking so much about the Bible as they are about society, about politics. They're saying all of the states except one, Illinois, all of the states except one in 1964 have sodomy laws on the books. You can be arrested for consensual, private, gay sex in every single state in the District of Columbia in 1964. And these ministers are saying, well, this doesn't seem very right. And also, this doesn't seem very Christian to proceed in this sort of way. Let's reconsider this. Let's reevaluate this. But then in the latter half of the 60s, we start to see an ethical and theological reevaluation happening as well. Folks say, okay, maybe we've misunderstood who exactly the sodomites are, who exactly, when we look at these passages, even if they don't use the word homosexual, if we look at Genesis 19, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, if we look at Leviticus 18 and 20, if we look at these Pauline passages, maybe what Paul had in mind when he used those words malakoi and arsenokoite, aren't exactly what we're seeing here today. Folks start asking these questions. We're not going to get deep into the weeds. This is something for Dr. Barreto or someone else to do with you all. But what I'm interested in as a historian is that it's Christians who are starting to ask these sorts of questions before there's a gay rights movement ascendant in the 70s. And what's especially interesting to me is that some of the folks who are asking these questions are folks that the guys at Christianity Today adore. So Helmut Thielicke is a German theologian. In 1964-65, publishes a book called The Ethics of Sex. And his, we wouldn't call his position an affirming one. He's going to say something like, you know, it's really a shame that we've got all these homosexuals running around, and maybe some of them can change. It'd be really nice if some of them could change. But also, maybe some of them can't. And if they can't, maybe what's best for the church, maybe the most Christian thing to do is to let them, right, like encourage monogamy, encourage love between them. We can have some of these homosexual couples in our churches. If they can't change, that's going to be fine. Maybe that's going to be fine. He's making this argument in the mid-60s. Christianity Today doesn't know what to do with this because he's one of their darlings. They love reviewing his books. They love talking about this true evangelical German theologian. And now all of a sudden he's talking about the homosexuals in this way that they're not used to, not comfortable with. And this is where we'd start showing you all these slides of all these fascinating people that we don't have time to talk too much about, these evangelical gay activists, because this just starts happening more and more. We start to see in 1968, this guy named Troy Perry founds a church called the Metropolitan Community Church in LA. It grows, it explodes. He's got 30, 40 congregations within just a handful of years. It's all over the country. It's in like the big cities on the coast, but it's also in like Boise and Omaha, and it's all through the Midwest. And what everyone, including the evangelical observers at Christianity Today and other places, what everyone is noticing up front about this new church movement is Troy Perry's kind of a fundamentalist. Troy Perry, like this is a Baptist, Pentecostal, Southern preacher. And you know, this church movement, I mean, there are homosexuals in there, but it kind of looks pretty conservative theologically and in terms of relationships, and it kind of just looks pretty evangelical. And throughout the 70s, evangelical writers are noticing this. And of course, the mainstream media is too. So we've got Troy Perry, the Metropolitan Community Church. We've got other folks who I'm not going to talk about now because it's about time to start moving toward questions. But to wrap up the Christianity Today thing, we've got our 50s, 60s, into the 70s. It's in the 60s and into the 70s that Christianity Today starts talking in earnest about, okay, well, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? And we start to see, in some cases just once a year, in some cases every 3 months, a new article come out. Well, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? You've heard Helmut Thielicke has said this, and you've heard folks at the MCC say this. But here's what the Bible says about homosexuality. And what I noticed reading all of these articles over the course of the 60s into the 70s, through the 70s and into the 80s, is that Christianity Today's own exegesis, their own way of explaining what the Bible clearly says about homosexuality, changes over time. And what happens is these five verses, I think all of them have been named for us so far, Genesis 19, Leviticus 18, 20, Romans 1, 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Timothy 1, they slowly start to, if not fall off, then just slowly there's an acknowledgement of Christianity Today that, well, some of these verses might not be as useful in convincing folks that Christianity, that the Bible condemns homosexuality, than others. And so we start seeing this drop off real quick in the 70s with Genesis 19. Okay, well, I guess this is a story about rape in Sodom. And so that has a lot to say about rape, and maybe not a lot to say about homosexuals today. And so Christianity Today starts to acknowledge that in a few of its articles. Same thing with Leviticus 18:20. It's okay, well, some will say, I guess, that this is the Levitical Mosaic Code, and I guess it is just kind of a few verses before and after other laws that no one takes seriously today in the Christian church. So maybe that one, that isn't very convincing either. And by the time we get to the late 70s, early 80s, some, not all, but some of Christianity Today's articles are going to say, okay, so we know that Paul didn't have, or it's at least conceivable that Paul didn't have actual homosexuals, people who have some sort of homosexual orientation, gay orientation in mind when he was writing back then. And maybe, right, like it's possible that like some will be convinced by the argument that that Paul didn't have any idea of loving monogamous unions between two homosexuals or two gay people. And so something shifts, and here's where I would most love to be able to show you one slide, because we're going to wrap up right now. But the one slide that I would show you is the very first cover story for Christianity Today about homosexuality. The first time homosexuals there on the cover, and this is what we're talking about. And it is in the 70s. It's in 1977. And what I would love to show you right now is the artwork of this cover, because it is a picture of two peacocks. One female peacock that is small and brown and is kind of just over here in the corner. And then a male peacock where the plumage is out. It's so big. That's pretty much it. That's the cover. There are no peacocks in this article. There are no animals other than humans in this article. So the question would be, in fact, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to like pull up this slide and set it here. And after we're done, you can come look at this picture, just because it's so fun. If we had time, then I would say, why do you think peacocks are what they chose to go with? You're right. No, so it's not about this is how they choose. It doesn't make sense unless you understand that there's a new way that Christianity Today is learning to talk about homosexuality, learning to talk about homosexuality in the Bible over the course of the 70s and into the 80s. Because there's one Bible passage that I haven't mentioned that gets used a lot these days by evangelicals. And that passage is Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Male and female, he created them. That doesn't come up hardly at all until the 70s, and it certainly isn't most prominent, until the late 70s, early 80s. And I noticed as I was reading, this is around the same time that we're starting to see acknowledgments. Well, Genesis 19, maybe that's not very convincing. And Leviticus 18:20, maybe that's not very convincing. And maybe some will say that Paul actually didn't have homosexuals in mind, but look how different these two peacocks are. The male peacock and the female peacock, these are totally different. How could you say that male and female, he created them, doesn't matter? That the differences, the natural, divinely ordained, fundamental differences between male and female, of whatever species apparently, isn't so important that of course the Bible plainly teaches, clearly condemns homosexuality. I see Genesis 1 and 2 coming in as something like compensation. Not because the secular gay rights movement is so convincing to evangelicals and to other Christians, but because some of these folks at the Metropolitan Community Church, some of the folks who are reading Tielicki, some of the folks who are reading other evangelical gay activists who I didn't get to talk about, it's not very many people, but it's thousands and thousands of evangelicals. Their ways of reading these scriptures are just threatening enough to more powerful evangelicals at Christianity today that we need to have some sort of alternative, new way of going about talking about why the Bible condemns homosexuality. And so Genesis 1 and 2 achieves a new prominence in evangelical discourse on homosexuality in this period. There's more that I'd say about that, plenty more to talk about, but I should probably stop there. And then just to rewind back from all of these little shifts we've been tracing, the shifts are the point for me. The point is to go back to that book and this notion of inevitability, this notion of a static one way in which evangelicalism and homosexuality have always related, have always been in relation, and to say that the history is more variable than that. There have been tensions and competition and shifts all along the way. I'm definitely stopping right there. I'm sorry that the slideshow wasn't able to work to give you some pictures to go with the words. Yeah, and I'd love to hear any questions. Yeah.
What were any of the other really prominent theologians of that time period, like the Niebuhrs? That's the one I came to mind right away. Were they addressing the issue of homosexuality at all?
In this like 60s, 70s period? Yeah, I think so. I can't think with the Niebuhrs off the top of my head. I mean, in the 60s, both liberal and conservative theologians alike are largely still, the majority of them are still operating with the idea, we didn't talk about psychiatry at all in this presentation, but are still operating with the idea that homosexuality has some sort is some sort of psychological maladjustment. So it is. It may also be a biblically condemned act, but it is also some sort of psychological problem. And that's the sort of thing that Christian, non-Christian, big theologian, little whomever, right? Like this is pretty much in the water through the 60s and into the 70s. So right, in terms of big name theologians, I don't know when the first or when some of the first outside of evangelical context, right, like theologians might have come out in some sort of affirming sort of way. But yeah.
Is Rahner homosexual?
The name once more?
Rahner?
Karl Rahner?
Karl Rahner.
Oh, I have no idea. Maybe. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Catholic discourse on homosexuality really picks up in the 70s as well with John McNeill's book, The Church and the Homosexual. But as far as Karl Rahner goes, I don't know.
Nouwen.
Henry Nouwen, yeah. Yeah.
What about the Jesus scholars?
Oh, yeah. No, that's a good question. So folks like Marcus Borg. So I've stuck, my dissertation is really digging deep into the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and also pretty much stuck with these evangelical folks. So I can't recall off the top of my head when the Jesus, critical Jesus scholarship started to speak differently. I mean, Jesus doesn't talk about homosexuality, right, in the same way that Paul is said to be talking about homosexuality. And so I could believe that it hasn't come up quite as much for those folks, but... Other questions? Yeah.
This point in 77, is this the point at which Christianity today switches and never looks back?
From what to what?
Article in 77.
I wouldn't put it that strongly. No, this is, 1977, 78 is a critical time for evangelical anti-gay attitudes at large. This is the period of Anita Bryant. This is Jerry Falwell is just beginning to come onto the scene. The idea that to be an evangelical is to be anti-gay is going to be accruing currency in these years, currency that will last for decades. This is a key turning point in that regard. It's not that Genesis 1 and 2 is the only thing that folks talk about after this period, and it's not that those five clobber passages, they're called, never get talked about again after this period. But for me, this cover which makes no sense outside, I think, of the kind of narrative that I've given, with details, right? Like, of course, you can quibble about all sorts of things. But this symbolizes for me a rise of a new way of talking about, for these folks, a new way of focusing the conversation on homosexuality. Because again, before this, Genesis 1 and 2 might come up a couple of times in the 70s, but like now this is the conversation. Why are we anti-gay? It's because of this way of understanding male-female difference, which we're going to root in Genesis 1 and 2. That dominates evangelical begins to dominate evangelical discourse on homosexuality from the late 70s on, at least with Christianity Today, in ways that it didn't before then. Yeah, he.
I wonder, to what extent do you see evangelical gay activism today versus people who might want evangelical communities to be more affirming, just no longer seeing the term evangelical as an important identity for themselves?
Yeah, thank you. Oh, that's right, I should have been doing that. Evangelical gay activists today, if you happen to have seen, there have been stories in Time, where else? We've seen folks talk about this guy, Matthew Vines, wrote a book called God and the Gay Christian. There was stuff about Justin Lee and the Gay Christian Network for a while. A lot of this reporting, a lot of this conversation happened around marriage equality in 2015. So here, look, here are also some evangelicals who support marriage equality. What I heard you asking, Heath, is how these evangelical gay activists in recent years may or may not differ from past evangelical gay activists, in part differing in that some of these folks, as I heard you saying, are distancing themselves from the evangelical label, even as they might still talk the same sort of way, use the same sort of language, but distance themselves from the label. I think there's something to that. I could believe that that has something to do with evangelical support for Trump and just like this stranglehold narrative, right? I believe that it's just, I don't want to be associated with that. I need folks to know that I'm not racist in that way, so I'm going to not even use this term. And then also, too, I think there's something to be said for a similarity here. The folks that I'm talking about, the evangelical gay activists in the 70s, 80s, and folks today, there's only so much you can stand. You can really believe with all your heart. No, I believe what you, we are brothers and sisters in Christ, and I believe what you believe, and I talk to God in the same way that you do. And I go to the same church, same whatnot. But like the more you just keep getting pushed out and pushed out and pushed out, eventually you just kind of walk out the door yourself. You're tired of being pushed. And I think that's happened with some of these folks in recent years. And I know that happened in the 70s and 80s too. Folks just got tired. It's after 10:20, yeah.
Can we give William a round of applause? Thank you so much for persevering across technical difficulties and kicking off our Emerging Leader series for adult ed. I hope you all can join us next week. We are going to be welcoming Chauncey Handy, who's actually a PhD student at the seminary, and he is going to be talking on Everyone is an Ethnic Reader, Ethnicity, and the Old Testament Interpretation. Thank you all so much for being here this morning.